69 inland, 62 near Lake Michigan. It's cloudy now and 54 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com.
And we welcome you to the morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm delighted to be sitting across the table from one of my faculty colleagues at Carthage College, Dr. Yuri Maltsev, who is a professor of economics there, part of the faculty of the Clausen Center. And Professor Maltsev joins us from time to time on the morning show, and we always have intriguing and interesting conversations, and I always appreciate the opportunity to hear his take, his interpretation of events both here and abroad. Professor Maltsev, in the course of his work at Carthage College, does a great deal of travel with students, and it is always interesting to hear about those experiences as well, which only enrich his worldview. And Professor Maltsev, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Oh, thank you, Greg. It's nice to be back.
Good to have you here. We primarily today want to talk about your perspective on the presidential administration thus far of President Donald Trump, and especially because you are an economist and a professor of economy, I guess is a better way to put it, we want to make sure that we spend plenty of time talking about what President Trump's intentions are as in terms of the American economy, the creation of jobs, simplification of the tax rolls, rollback of regulations, certain hallmarks to his platform and perspective, which don't get talked a lot about a lot because of certain other matters, of course, that are swirling around the president at the moment. But these are important matters as well. First of all, just on maybe kind of a general and maybe even, let's say, you know, rather personal level, what has your sense been of the presidency of Donald Trump? And has it played out in the way that you would have expected it to play out?
I think that election of Mr. Trump is kind of a gift which keeps on giving. It's both interesting from the point of the content of his economic policies, which are pretty sound, and also it's pretty entertaining, I would say. Then what I think I didn't expect is this slow motion kind of socialist revolution against him. The coup d'etat, which is kind of brewing in Washington, D.C. I am myself Russian and ethnic Russian. I'm American citizen, but I'm ethnic Russian. And I was not a friend and never been a friend of Mr. Putin. But I think that all this hoopla about Russian intervention into our elections, about Russians manipulating Mr. Trump, is the most egregious, I would say, attempt to deprive a constitutionally elected president from exercising his duties.
Hmm. So your sense is that there is no factual basis for kind of the concerns that have been raised. Your own suspicions are that there was no collusion there whatsoever when it came to this most recent election, or significant interference from the Russians. I guess that's two different questions, isn't it?
I had a fortune or misfortune to read the CIA and other 16 intelligence or agencies' memo about Russian interference in our elections last November, and there is nothing, zero, zilch, nothing. It looks like this memo was made by Soviet Pravda propaganda people. It's, for example, they're saying on 8 pages, I devoted the role of Russian television in our elections. How many of you are watching Russian television? Mm. And even if you do, how many of you would follow what they would tell you to vote for Trump instead of Mrs. Clinton? And then overall, even if this is true, what's wrong with that from a legal point of view? I can make up my mind to whom to vote for by reading Le Monde or Frankfurter Allgemeine or London Times. There's nothing illegal in this.
Right. I mean, for someone in Russia, even somebody higher up, to have a certain hope for the way our election would go, and even to write about that, to broadcast about that, there is nothing illegal about that.
Absolutely. And I think that Mr. Trump, he made some compliments to Mr. Putin, mostly because Mr. Putin was the only foreign leader who complimented Mr. Trump. And at that time, there was such a shortage of these compliments, such a scarcity of any respect for Mr. Trump from overseas or here, that Mr. Trump he complimented Mr. Putin back. But my last article about Mr. Putin, published in Russian, had a self-descriptive title, Meat Voted for a Meat Grinder. So I am very much upset with Mr. Putin because he is a proud member of the KGB, which murdered anywhere from 40 to 60 million people. So this is, I would be the first one who would kind of smell the rat there. I would be the first one who would be against it. And then 11 long months, Mr. Comey, who is not my favorite as well, because he's a class warrior, if you remember, that he was the one who locked up Martha Stewart for covering a crime, which didn't happen. And so 11 months was spent just to put kind of monkey wrenches in Mr. Trump's campaign at first and Mr. Trump's presidency.
One of the maybe more significant concerns that's being raised regarding President Trump is that even if these Russian ties or the charges of collusion prove to be groundless, as you are suggesting, some are saying that there is the real possibility that the president may have crossed a line when it comes to obstruction of justice, of not allowing unfettered investigation to go forward of that, and in this respect, not to make predictions of what's going to happen, but in the same way that what got President Nixon into the most serious trouble was not any break in at Watergate, but his attempts to cover it up, and I mean obstruction of justice ended up being what brought his presidency down. Do you see at the moment evidence that President Trump has crossed that kind of line and is in maybe the most serious jeopardy because of this matter of obstruction of justice?
I would say the most interesting and visible U.S. lawyer and civil rights activist and civil libertarian is Alan Dershowitz. He just was a couple of days ago on Carlson Tucker program. And he said there's absolutely no obstruction of justice. The president has all constitutional rights to do what he did. He has a right to stop any investigation. He has a right to, if there is no crime already confirmed, like in the case of Mr. Nixon, that the president has a right to fire whomever he likes to in executive branch. And so it was very interesting for me to see that. And Mr. Comey, who all Democrats hated with great passion, because I remember Mrs. Clinton, she was talking about this, some kind of a Comey-Putin conspiracy to keep her out of the White House, that Comey was accused with all these high crimes and misdemeanors by the Democrats. And now when President Trump fired him, it turned out that he is obstructing justice in this or that way. We have a lot of people, especially on the networks like CNN or in the newspapers like Washington Post, who has this irrational hatred or, I don't know, kind of like a serious case of allergy against Mr. Trump, so they cannot think clearly. So they are talking about constitutional crisis, for example, or obstruction of justice, or other things which are just not there.
We're speaking with Dr. Yuri Maltsev, who is a professor of economics at Carthage College, and we're spending a few minutes getting his perspective on the presidency of Donald Trump thus far, and in a moment we will move to economic matters. I was interested, as I read a couple of articles in National Review, how some of those writers in the course of defending President Trump in somewhat the same matter that you just have, actually speaking pretty frankly about his, I mean, in at least one case, speaking about his competency, in fact, in the sense of him coming to the presidency as someone who has never held political office, never really operated in the hallways of political life at all, and pointing to, you know, of course, some of the disarray in terms of the way that the White House itself has functioned. And I was, I mean, it's not a surprise to read those kind of comments in certain news outlets, but I was a little surprised to see it spoken so frankly in a place like National Review, although by no means is that the only sort of take you would have of President Trump there. There are other writers there who are, of course, much more complimentary. I'm really curious to have your opinion of President Trump, in a sense, as an administrator, the way he has administered the office thus far, even apart from matters of policy, more in terms of the way that the White House has operated. That certainly has been subject of great criticism. Do you think that criticism is warranted, or is that also indicative of a more pervasive anti-Trump bias, and are people complaining about disarray that in fact isn't there? Again, speaking administratively of how the White House is functioning.
Of course, yes. Well, first I want to kind of make a brief disclaimer about National Review. National Review is a hotbed of never-Trumpers.
Of what?
Never-Trumpers, so-called. Ah. That means that they will have some rogue Republicans and rogue people on the right who hate Mr. Trump with great passion. And Jonas Goldberg is one of them, definitely, who is the chief editor of the National Review. From another hand, yes, Mr. Trump, definitely, I agree that that's why he was elected, because he's not a professional bureaucrat. He doesn't have any government experience. And that's what American people liked in him. I agree that sometimes his especially tweets are pretty entertaining, if not outrightly laughable. But from another hand, this is form. This is form. It's not a content. Content-wise, I think he surrounded himself with very able people in all fields, in fields of economics, fields of foreign policy, fields of national security. So I would say that I don't care what kind of haircut he has if he wants to protect this country, if he wants to protect our economic system. Because for me, to tell the truth, because I came from the Soviet Union, which was completely devastated by its own government and its socialist economic policies. Anywhere again from 40 to 60 million people were put to death because of these policies. So for me, I'm always voting just, I don't care about names, haircuts, genders, race, or whatever else. If this is a socialist, then I don't vote. Then if it's a capitalist, I do. Hmm. And everything else is, yes, I think that he made a lot of mistakes. He made a lot of mistakes, but these mistakes are pretty minor. I think the worst mistake he made, that he fired General Flynn. And that he would not stand behind the person who stood behind him. Because that was the most egregious, I would say, surrender to the left. I don't think that we have enough time to discuss Mr. Flynn. But Mr. Flynn is accused of getting $6,000 for visiting Russia. $6,000 was his expenses. Bill Clinton went to Russia at the same time. He got $800,000, out of which $300,000 for expenses. I don't know what kind of expenses is that. What did he do to Russians? He made jokes for 40 minutes for $500,000. I think this is a bribe. I think this should be investigated, if anything. I'm not much into these conspiracies or investigations, but from another hand, if you will look, Clinton Foundation received $35 million for uranium deal. Uranium deal, you remember Uranium One scandal in 2012, and nobody talks about it. Because what we see right now, I think, that is an attempt to if not impeach, then to paralyze the president who was duly elected and installed.
Right. Why would President Trump capitulate on the matter of Michael Flynn? What possible reason would there be for him to in a sense, throw him under the bus, as the phrase goes? I mean, that just seems to fly in the face of who President Trump is, a very strong figure who does what he wants to do. What would the reason be for him to?
I hate to say that. I don't see him as a very strong figure. I think that sometimes he's scared. He really doesn't have any experience with the government. He doesn't know what's around this corner or that. And the best example is spending bill, which was passed by Congress, 3 weeks ago, at the end of April. And this this spending bill is Chuck Schumer. He said that we achieved everything. All goals of the Democratic Party are right there. And it completely corresponds to the values of the Democratic Party. Why Mr. Trump did that? Just because I think he wanted not to be associated with shutdown of the government. So until September, he bought himself some time. So it's I'm thinking he is a warrior, but not kind of a warrior that I would prefer to see there.
Interesting. One of those articles again that I was reading in National Review, one of the criticisms leveled at President Trump, I think to some extent, is in line with what you were just saying, is this writer, who I think, like you, feels great sympathy for a lot of President Trump's policy perspectives, wishes President Trump would stop, in his words, sweating the small stuff. Overreacting to things that really are of, in the grand scheme of things, of no consequence. In other words, President Trump is far too sensitive, and reacts strongly and often impulsively to what really are minor insults from some late night talk show host or something. But I mean, he will be tweeting about that in the next morning. And this particular writer, I mean, wishes President Trump could show more restraint when it comes to that, and just not be paying attention to all that. And his sense is President Trump pays too much attention to that at the detriment of getting his policies implemented. Does that sound like it makes sense?
Well, it does, definitely. Yeah, during the campaign, I remember I thought that he doesn't have any chance, for that very reason, that he is chasing all squirrels he could see.
Chasing squirrels, yeah.
Yes, that was, he wouldn't focus on the real issues, and sometimes he would talk about, with very, I would say, with very strong and unwarranted personal attacks on, I think Mr. Rubio, for example, Senator Marco Rubio, even today he hates Trump because of the way he was humiliated during the campaign. And this doesn't, I think it doesn't help. But from another hand, it looks like Mr. Trump is getting where he wants to be. To be. So maybe, I don't know, maybe I am, and that author, maybe we just don't understand something about American electorate, and so maybe people like him tweeting at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Well, it certainly, in a sense, gives the public another kind of access to the president that we're not used to having, and of course, we are used in recent history to the image of the president being presented in very sort of carefully manicured fashion, mm-hmm. with handlers and spin masters around them, making mm-hmm. massaging the message before it ever sort of gets out. Or at least that's the perception. To some extent, I'm sure it's true. And here we have a president who, particularly in his tweets, is completely unedited.
Exactly, yes. Well, I think that's also the calling of times, because we have the new time when the president and new technology, when the president can go over the heads of mass media, just directly talk to American people. This is a very good thing. However, saying that, I also think that that's another great, I would say, some kind of great gift to all of us, that Mr. Trump, definitely he cannot be seen as an imperial president. You see what I mean? If you will look at the presidents from beginning, well, I came to the United States and worked at first for the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush in Washington, D.C. And there were numerous attempts to kind of to sanctify Mr. Bush, to sanctify Mr. Clinton, another Bush and Obama. This imperial presidency image, that the president is above people, that the president is something on a high pedestal. But Mr. Trump, definitely, he brings, as Napoleon would say, the throne down to the people. and that's why I think it's another thing. It's not a good thing, because the more he tweets, the less totalitarian society is looming upon us.
Let me just push back in this respect. Do you think when somebody is the president and wields the kind of power and influence that the president has, that there isn't the potential for something dangerous occurring if the president is expressing his own sort of knee-jerk reactions to whatever occurs? The world listens to the president the way it listens to nobody else on earth. And are you worried about the potential of something really bad maybe occurring with the president expressing himself in this kind of fashion so freely?
Well, I don't see the danger of that. I would see the danger from exactly the opposite thing.
That would worry you more.
Yes, that would worry me more. And look, the world, it looks like, is turning around and really began to look at Mr. Trump with some kind of new fascination and new respect. I mean, look, his foreign trip is going so successfully, and he achieved so much more, say, in our dealings with Saudi Arabia or Palestinians or Israel, to that matter. So I think that he should probably pay more attention to foreign policy, because he is way more popular overseas than here.
Interesting. I think the critics of President Trump would say that when it comes to foreign policy, he did not come to the job with, of course, any demonstrable experience. And of course, in certain matters, when he's asked, you can just sort of tell that he's trying to say something without knowing very much in terms of the specifics. What do you think it is that he brings to the arena of foreign policy that allows him to be as successful as he is? Because it would not be experience in the most conventional sense of the word. Does he bring another kind of experience to the table when it comes to foreign policy?
I think he does, definitely, because his career in business, especially. I think that those who are interested in finding out what Mr. Trump thinks about, there's a great book that he wrote himself in 1986, I think, The Art of the Deal.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, I know some people teaching management and business administration are using this book even in their classes. And and in that book, he is making a point that there is really an art of the deal, and I think he's personally, at least to that people, he's personally very attractive. He is their kind of person, the person of the world, and he is. I think that his golfing experience is helping him in his foreign policy as well.
His
golfing experience, golfer. He is a golfer,
right?
He started a lot of golf clubs all around the world.
Oh, I see.
Yes,
okay.
And so he is. And when you start this, then you're hanging around with a lot of people of elites. And so he knows what what he is. He has a charming family, and he brings them all along. That's also another interesting aspect, I think, of Mr. Trump's presidency, that he is pretty flamboyant in bringing his friends and family on board, and that was and that's all explicit, and they all don't get any money and whatnot, while some others who would bring their families just for enrichment.
Hmm. What would you say have been you're characterizing this current trip, which of course has taken him to the Middle East and now to the Vatican. In what way do you think this trip has been successful for President Trump?
I would think that the most successful leg of this trip was his trip to Riyadh and his speech, which right now is being reprinted by almost all newspapers all over the world. I think that he is trying to establish a very good partnership between Saudis and the United States. And this, many people in the United States have a very wrong impression that Saudis are our enemies, that Saudis engineered 9/11 and things like that. Yes, there were Saudis, 15 of 19 9/11 perpetrators were Saudis. But to say that Saudis hate the United States, or it's just the same as we would say that as Jeff Dahmer is from Wisconsin, we are all cannibals.
Mm.
Here. No, this is not. We shouldn't stereotype that. And the kingdom, and the desert kingdom, they suffered even more from the hands of terrorists than almost anybody else. And so because of that, I think that they are our natural allies. And he reestablished good relations with them. This is very good. I mean, President Obama, when he was bowing to to the king and was trying to say how great is Islam, Mr. Trump is without any losing any kind of face or without contradicting himself when he was criticizing some parts of Islamic community, he restored it all. Besides that, I think that was symbolically that was very interesting that his daughter and his wife didn't wear hijab, unlike, say, Mrs. Clinton or Mrs. Obama. And these are symbols which for us maybe are not very important, but for Saudis it is very important. I think that this trip, according to at least to people I know, I have a good friend who is teaching there in Riyadh, and he emailed me that they achieved more in promoting the role of women in Islamic society than anybody else before. And and Ivanka Trump especially, she fundraised about $100 million for the World Bank Foundation, which will be dealing with the role of women in economic development, which is also extremely important. And sure enough, if you will look at CNN, immediately they call it Ivanka Fund and whatever. That's not her fund. This is trying to say that there's absolutely no difference between her fund and Mrs. Clinton's kind of fundraising for the Clinton Foundation. So so I think that this is very important and interesting. Look how he was received in Palestine. A lot of people were greeting him, calling him man of peace. That's also none of the American president achieved for quite a while. So people have hope. I don't know whether it will all materialize. But what he's doing right, I think.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Yuri Maltsev. He is a professor of economics at Carthage College. And we should turn in the last minutes of our conversation to matters of the American economy. And for that matter, the sort of the global economy as well, of course. The two are so intertwined now in a way that once upon a time was not the case. I think it would be interesting to spend a few minutes having you clarify something that you said earlier in the interview, which you have certainly said on other occasions as well, namely your aversion to socialism and anything that smacks of socialism. And I think in your view, America has been creeping towards that system in a way that has been really alarming to you. Explain the ways in which you feel that was the direction in which we were turning towards socialism? In what way was our economy becoming, at least in some respects, socialist?
Well, in the United States, I think that especially during the last 30, 40 years, we had a great increase in the role of the state in economic affairs. What is socialism? Socialism is nothing but the state. State ownership or government ownership or what Marx called public ownership. There's no such thing as public, so it's government ownership. And it was on the increase all of the time. Besides that, we had a regulatory state almost exploded, especially during the last years of Clinton, during George W. Bush administration, during Obama administration. So that was something which Lenin called that we don't need to nationalize everything. We will just make capitalists work for us. And this is exactly what regulatory state do achieve. We lost comparative advantage in many industries, and that's what Mr. Trump, I think, promised to kind of to provide remedy for. Besides that, on the cultural front, there was an Italian Marxist, Antonio Gramsci, and who was saying that, yeah, we don't need any violent revolutions anymore. We should just promote socialism through education, through culture, through mass media. And so this is what we've got. I mean, if you will look at political correctness, if you look at the riots at, say, Berkeley or Middlebury College or things like that, when the innocent people were hurt just because some speakers that they don't want to hear were on campus. So this are pretty bad signs. Then I think I'm kind of pretty old. I live here in Wisconsin, whatever. But I was already looking for another defection destination lately because this country was going, I would say, almost kind of down the drain. If you will look what socialism looked like, look at Venezuela, look at Cuba. Both Venezuela and Cuba were the most prosperous countries in Latin America in 1959. The most prosperous. Venezuela was number four in the world in the standard of living. And look what's happening right now. People, I just returned back from Brazil, another victim of socialism. And there is a lot of Venezuelans in Brazil telling me about attacks on the zoos. The people attack zoos. For what reason? To eat animals there. There are no more rats, no more. Venezuela was not a very clean place. They had a lot of rats, stray dogs, stray cats, and things like that. None of them survived socialism. So this is what I see, and this is what I'm afraid of, that it is very easy to be lured by these wonderful songs of socialism about equality, about justice, and things like that. But it usually turns out in exactly into the opposite.
Is it possible to pursue those ideals you were just mentioning, like equality, access to all, and so on? Is it possible to work for those goals without tapping into the sort of the hallmarks of socialism, or are they so intricately entwined that you're going to inevitably get one with the other, in your opinion?
Yes, of course. I think that it is possible, and we have this equality before the law, equality in the eyes of the creator. This kind of equality is real equality. Equality of results is phony equality. It is equality based on social envy. If you have equality of results, you can only be achieved in complete misery. I think that that Dwight Eisenhower used to say that if you want free health care, free dental care, free food and free shelter, go to jail. And that's exactly, I think, what socialism is.
So how does President Trump, in terms of the policies that he has laid out thus far and, of course, that he talked about in his campaign, what is the hope that he offers to you to turn this around? What would be the most significant ways in which this move would be reversed?
Yes, I think that the hope that we have in President Trump is that he would reverse these trends of the past, trends of not even 8 years of Obama, but trends of the last 30 years. And I think that would be that. And also he can build a great economy because we talked about, we didn't talk actually about the economy, but economy, his economic program of low taxes, of getting rid of regulations which are unnecessary, to get rid of a lot of things that we don't understand much, like global warming, that all these issues are extremely, extremely important in providing hopes for our children.
Let's talk about one of the I want to talk about each of the things you've mentioned, but let's talk for a moment about, for instance, simplification of our tax code. Mm-hmm. What are the ways in which our tax code at the moment are too complicated, and what is the harm of that, aside from the frustration people have as they try to do their taxes with that frustration, which is that's significant to some extent, but I think you believe it is significant even beyond that, beyond the mental well-being of an individual taxpayer. We are hurt collectively by a tax code that is too complicated. How so?
Yes, we there are some studies by, say, Sam Peltzman from University of Chicago that was spent about $1 trillion overhead on our tax system, which is unbelievably high. We have so many people. We have 300,000 tax accountants and tax lawyers in the United States. I have a PhD in economics. I cannot do my taxes. Or if I do, I'm being audited or something. Yeah, so this is so what Mr. Trump wants to do, he wants first, and this is most important even than simplification of the code, he wants to reduce taxes. Reduce taxes, corporate taxes, to 15%.
I remember you saying that our corporate tax at the moment is the highest among...
The highest in the world. Yeah. Right? The highest in the world among the developed or developing countries. Nobody has 35 to 40% taxes, corporate taxes. So Canada has 15%. Ireland has 12%. So why would you invest in the United States if better kind of opportunities are available and available everywhere? In Singapore, it's almost zero. Estonia, Chile. These are the countries with very low tax rates. It's difficult for us to compete with them. Mr. Trump all the time is saying that we should return back jobs which we lost to foreign. Why did we lose these jobs? Because the United States became unattractive for businesses because the business environment became hostile to entrepreneurs. And this is the worst kind of thing that we encountered. And that's why, then besides that, he wants to simplify this. This is also a great thing. So we'll have only three tax brackets. I mean, if that will be my way, I maybe would have just one. We'll have a flat tax or whatever, like they have, say, in Chile, the same Chile, in Estonia, in other 30 countries, which is the most simple and business-friendly. But he's not ready for that, but this is a good step in the right direction.
And in terms of reforming our tax code, where does it make sense for the benefit to rest most prominently? I mean, does it make sense for the rich to pay less taxes or for the poor to pay less taxes or the middle class? I mean, it sounds like overall we will all pay fewer taxes, but where is it, in terms of our overall economic benefit, where should there be the most reduction?
Well, the most reduction would be the people who are paying the most taxes. That's so funny for me to hear that, for example, from Chuck Schumer or Nancy Pelosi, that these are all tax systems for the rich. Yes, they are, because poor do not pay taxes. 50% of taxpayers, that's from Washington Post, 50% are not paying federal income tax. I'm even surprised that Washington Post is calling them taxpayers, even if they're not paying any taxes. So these are we have a highly progressive tax system. When people on the very top, 1%, is paying 36% of all taxes. If you will look at the top 20%, they're paying already almost all taxes, 60%. So if you will look, it's all on IRS page, on the IRS website. So this is what I think is the most important for us to keep that taxes. They reduce the activity they tax. Income tax is tax on work. So the more you because 78% of all income in the United States is income from work, from work for hire, for employment.
Another matter that you mentioned that I want us to explore is the rollback of regulations. And, of course, for certain people with certain concerns, that kind of talk can be alarming because the assumption often gets made that that means eliminating all regulations or rolling them back to such an extent that our air is polluted like it once was or other things our water is no longer safe to drink, and so on. If the matter of regulation is left to industry to decide how much they want to be regulated, and of course, generally speaking, industry doesn't welcome the interference of regulations, and some would argue, well, but those regulations serve a purpose for our general welfare, even if in the immediate moment they inflict some pain on industry. I think you would argue that the matter of regulation has gone too far. How far is too far, or how do we figure out the level of regulation with which we can live?
Greg, I would even argue that all the regulations came from industry, that regulations is nothing else but the way to keep outsiders out, that regulations, all regulations, if you will look, all regulations around us are against poor people, are against small businesses. These are the regulations. I mean, it's obvious, yes. I mean, for example, I don't know, the exhaust controls in the state of Wisconsin. Who is driving these cars which can produce, the rich, they are driving the Bentleys and Jaguars, brand new ones, with no problem with emissions. But what I'm saying, or the food regulations. I worked for administration of George Herbert Walker Bush, as I mentioned in His last act was that we need to know, that now if you buy a bottle of water, how much of cholesterol is there, how much carbs, how much everything. For whom it's difficult to comply? For a big company? For Kraft? No. Because they produce their bologna the same every day for 365 days a year. But if you are a small company, then it is difficult. It is difficult to comply that this batch would be exactly like another batch. And most other regulations are also like that. Environmental regulations, that's in most cases is the way that one industry is trying to get rid of competitors which are substitutes of their products. So this regulations wise, we have something which is called in economics, that regulators are being captured by regulated. That the same people who are regulators, they usually would come from regulated industries, and they would serve their interests because the presidents would come and go, and their political appointees, and then it was just a revolving door. They will come back to the industry that they were regulated and get some paybacks from that. So Mr. Trump is not much into kind of his formula, however, is very interesting, that if you want a new regulations, you should get rid of two other ones. So if I want to regulate something, then I should come up with a couple of regulations that I'm saying we should get rid of, which is pretty good kind of idea, I think, because we overregulated ourselves. That's why. And then the same very people who would say that the rich people are so bad, whatever, but then we're losing jobs. I mean, what kind of poor people ever employed anyone? This is a pretty kind of strange duplicity that we have.
I did want to ask you about that because, of course, that is one phenomenon of the American economy that I think at a glance does not look very socialist. That is that we have this widening gap between the rich and the poor, and I think most of us, at least in the most simplistic sense, think of socialism or things like systems like it as where everybody ends up kind of being on the same plane, a plane of mediocrity, someone would argue that has a problem with that. But, of course, we don't see that. We see this widening gap. First of all, does that trouble you, that gap between rich and poor in this country? If it doesn't, why not? If it does bother you, how do we square that with some of these other policy perspectives that we've been talking about?
Well, it doesn't bother me at all because people are different. People have different ambitions, different incentives, different productivity. That's the most important. That what determines income? Productivity does. And then you have, lately, you have the last 20 years, you have something called digital divide. And digital divide is creating a lot of this, a lot of inequality. For example, I came to Carthage in 1991, and I immediately was offering these trips because I lived in this cruel Soviet Union. We couldn't travel, so I kind of became a travel freak, and so I was organizing these trips. How would I organize a trip, say, in 1995 even? I would go to a travel agency. There were so many of them here in Kenosha, maybe 30, 40 at least. Now how many of them left? Maybe one or two.
Hmm.
For what reason? Because everything, now if I'm traveling, I'm going to Expedia, I'm going to Travelocity, I'm going on any kind of internet providers. Travelocity or Expedia, they replace hundreds of thousands of travel agents. And they're getting the same 7% commission. So sure enough that people who came up with Priceline or Expedia, they became multimillionaires. The people like Zuckerberg with his Facebook or Brin in Google or whatnot, this entrepreneurship is paid very lavishly. And rightly so. There was a great Austrian economist, Joseph Alois Schumpeter. He died in 1950. He came up with this theory of something called creative destruction. Creative destruction. That we have that the wonders of capitalism is that it all the time creates something new. But in the process, it destroys a lot. Mm. And we see this destroyed. For example, we have digital photography. So the whole industry, and I knew one person also from Russia, he worked in Schomburg making film in Fuji plant making film for, and he lost his job.
I was going to say, not anymore.
Yes, not anymore. And he lost his job, and he complained loudly and invisibly, and so we know that people are losing. However, do we want to return back to this, to process films again, to make digital photography, which is costless, less affordable?
Even if we wanted to, we can't.
Yes.
There's no...
We can't. Exactly. Well, I was in Florida. I met a nice gentleman there. He's from Scotland. He's an impersonator of Rod Stewart. And pretty good impersonator. I think he's better than Rod Stewart. And he was a professional photographer. Now, because everybody has a cell phone, everybody is taking pictures. I mean, professional photography went down the drain, almost the whole profession. So these are the issues the issues of progress. And in the process, definitely, some people would be way more successful. But why they're more successful? Because they benefit us with everything. In a real market economy, you can only get ahead if you provide somebody else with what they want.
That's the engine for everything.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Well, on that note, we are out of time, and I apologize for all the noise in the background. I'm not sure our listeners are even hearing it. There's work being done here in the Bioscience Center at Gateway, but that has not interrupted our conversation, and this has been a very, very interesting one, as usual. Dr. Yuri Maltsev is professor of economics at Carthage College. Professor Maltsev, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. I'm so glad that you could make time in your schedule to join me today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, another faculty colleague, Jerry Mast from the Political Science Department, will be joining us to offer his perspective on the Trump presidency. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.